distinguished speaker, Dr. Willa McCarty from King's College London. I'll turn it over to you, Willa.
Thank you, Stan. Today, I'm going to begin not so much by reviewing what's come before as by decloaking an argument that I haven't yet quite made. The reward for those of you who have survived thus far is to see how strong a claim I've been hiding. Strong in the sense of strong AI, that is, being more bold than it is wise, perhaps, so that you're given the chance to challenge it. So I'm going to decloak today. But in previous lectures, I've argued, just for a little review, that the incunabular years from the end of World War II to the onset of the web in August 1991, during that time, computers made people anxious, and that there's more to this anxiety, much more, and much more to be respected than might first seem. On behalf of digitally orientated scholars of literature, I have argued that we are in need of a history to understand where we are and where we are going, and for that reason, we cannot afford to ignore this widespread anxiety or fail to look into its sources, its causes and implications, even though it may seem a thing of the past. I say seems because our domesticating relation to the computer as appliance, though appropriate for a range of jobs that computers now do, masks a Pyrrhic victory over a very different relation to the machine, a relation that would enable a much brighter future than might otherwise await literary computing. In other words, the story I am telling has two sides that play off against each other, and so must both be understood. Despite my beginning and several recursions to the dark side, the whole lecture series, and this lecture in particular, is about the bright side and its reception history in literary studies. It is about the vision that has informed and powered the work of computing, not the silly slave dreams of a supposed liberation from all work by some advanced technology so that humankind might enjoy a significantly underspecified leisure. The vision, rather, is that which William Blake called expanding eyes. I quote Northrop Frye once again, who, commenting on a life of perfecting rather than avoiding work, writes that what such a life brings forth, call it a poem, he says, is made out of both conscious and unconscious materials. The conscious is something that nobody short of a bodhisattva can control, but in certain mental places, it can find its own mode of expression. When it does so, it forms a kind of transformer of mental power, sending its voltage into its readers until, as Blake says, the expanding eyes of man behold the depth of wondrous worlds. This may seem more than a bit over the top for computing, but why should it be? Really, why is the computer not as potentially creative an instrument as any, if not more so than some? Why cannot we regard the machine in the way that a musician regards a musical instrument? Indeed, the way a digital musician regards the computer. Visual, plastic, and musical artists have, after all, been there before us since at least the 1960s. If we cannot find a vision of computing, however underdeveloped it may be, that can match the native imaginative power of the humanities, voltage for voltage, then either we need to come up with it or leave computing to the implementers and their deliverables. Let me now turn directly to an historian, John Lewis Gaddis, who is professor of military and naval history at Yale, and so to be believed when he writes about the positive light history shines on us. His book, The Landscape of History, begins with Caspar David Friedrich's The Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog. The impression it leaves, Gaddis says, is contradictory, suggesting at once mastery over a landscape and the insignificance of an individual within it. And this is what he thinks history is all about, an experience at once exhilarating and terrifying, whose point, sharpened by study, is an ability to shift back and forth between humility and mastery. In Adam's terms, that is, the mythological first man, this humility is etymological and mythological, namely our Lapsarian belonging to that red earth. In Copernican terms, It is our eccentric unimportance within the cosmos. In Darwinian, that our uniqueness among living things is an unsupported, self-regarding fiction. In Freudian, that psychologically we are not as we thought we were and remain only indirectly known to ourselves. And now, in computational terms, that quite possibly cognition as we have understood it is something far greater and beyond exact description. Thus, at the very end of his last unfinished lecture, John von Neumann wrote that, quote, "When we talk mathematics, we may be discussing secondary language, built on a primary language truly used by the central nervous system. Whatever that system is, it cannot fail to differ considerably from what we consciously and explicitly consider as mathematics." Again, arrival turns out to be a new departure. And in that departure, that expansion beyond is the brightness that I seek. And so where is it exactly? In this lecture, I want to find clues to it historically in the sense of excitement widely felt among those involved with computing in the early years, their sense that they were nearing a point of arrival, and to see what can be made from its vantage point. I want to look again and deeper into the question of why the excitement, where it was felt, primarily in and beyond, around cybernetics, why it seems to have been lost on us humanists. There are, of course, fairly obvious reasons for this loss, to which I will return. But I do think, as I said, that if we have a bright future, directions to it are to be found by playing off the excitement found elsewhere against the great imaginative failure of which Joseph Millich wrote. We need to look closely, as it happens we actually can, at a moment of problematic intersection. Again, to revive a point from the last lecture, the important matter here cannot be seen within a paranoid style of history, because even amidst a cynical time of transferable skills and all the rest of the current nonsense, we must be able to accept the intellectual enthusiasm of mid-20th century researchers as genuine. We must again be able to accept the possibility of innocence in a time of corruption and to recognize it. Indeed, beautiful innocence remains, for example, in artificial intelligence amidst all the slick PR and outrageous claims that it makes such easy targets. To put the matter back into the time of literary computing's origins, we must be able to accept the possibility that scientists funded by and involved in the war effort, and those who benefited from the cascades of money which the sinister, very sinister, Cold War research put into circulation, were intellectually curious, that they entertained ideas, conducted experiments, and made things because they were curious, because they wanted to know and to understand. Of course, it also helps to realize, for example, what was at stake in Europe in the early 1940s, why defending the realm was so commanding a responsibility. It helps to examine oneself closely before casting stones, and then to look to where and when innocence becomes genuinely possible. As a prelude to close inspection, allow me now to put before you a very sketchy but indicative catalog of non-specialist publications in English from the end of World War II to the first conference in literary computing, the Literary Data Processing Conference held by IBM in Yorktown Heights, New York, in 1964. The point I want to make is how easy it was to get more than a whiff of what was happening beyond the closed doors of laboratories during the first 18 or so years of computing. My catalog is derived from a desultory collection of about 500 publications, which I delimited by date from a larger collection of about 2,000 items. I have selected first appearances of computing in widely available, influential sources of note, and for anything that gives emphasis to the promise of computing. I have not selected anything specifically on cybernetics because I want to pay close attention to that topic later. I'm going to recite the items in this catalog, so hang on. The recitation will take a while to get through, but the cumulative effect is, I think, worth the endurance it will demand of you. On November 1st, 1946, an article on an electronic brain solving abstruse problems, valves with memory, that's vacuum tubes, with memory, appeared in the Times of London, the first of many. Across the pond, by the end of January 1948, IBM had completed its selective sequence automatic calculator and put it on display in the front window of its world headquarters in Madison Avenue, New York City, open to visitors, where it remained until 1952. Passersby nicknamed the machine Papa. In 1949, Warren McCulloch and John Pfeiffer published Of Digital Computers Called Brains in the magazine The Scientific Monthly. And Edmund Callis Berkeley published Giant Brains or Machines That Think with John Wiley and Sons about a kind, he declares in the preface, that comes closer to being a brain that thinks than any machine ever did before 1940. In 1950, Alan Turing published the highly accessible but seminal essay Computing Machinery and Intelligence in the philosophical journal Mind, where he proposed what we now call the Turing test. That year, the New Yorker column, The Talk of the Town, took notice of IBM's big brain on Madison Avenue, its cerebral parts, and the questions hard enough and important enough for the calculator to bother with. Claude Shannon wrote in the Philosophical Magazine on the intellectual challenges of programming a computer for playing chess. A cartoon of a mainframe, the Harvard Mark III, seen here again, appeared on the cover of Time magazine with the caption, Can Man Build a Superman? Time, with roughly 64 articles from 1946 to 1964, took an enduring interest, as did the Globe and Mail, which began noticing computers in this year. By 1951, non-specialist publications on the Great Machine Translation Project, or Mechanical Translation as it was then known, had begun to appear. The first international conference on that topic was held the next year. Also in 1951, Harper's Magazine, beginning an interest in computing that lasted throughout the incunabular decades, published an article on electronics and human beings about the prospect that automation could free men forever from boring and disagreeable tasks. You're all freed, right? In 1952, the Times reported on an exciting international symposium on mentality in machines, the papers of which were published that year by the Aristotelian Society. The next year, 1953, the papers of another symposium in the UK were published by Pitman and Sons in the book Faster Than Thought. In 1954, J. Robert Oppenheimer, in his report of the director 1948 to 1953 to the Institute for Advanced Study, Princeton, which included a school of historical studies, described von Neumann's project to build an electronic computer. The same year, W. Suckland's Pelican paperback, Minds and Machines, came out. By 1955, if not earlier, a kit with instructions for building GENIAC, a simple electric brain machine, was widely available. Unfortunately, we have no records of how many sons and daughters of professors in the humanities had such kits. I remember building them in the 50s myself. In 1955, in Scientific American, John Kemeny summarized at length von Neumann's lectures at Princeton on human and mechanical brains. The same year, McCulloch responded to the anxieties that Kemeny's report must have stirred in yet another Scientific Monthly piece, this time highly ironical, entitled Mysterium Iniquitatis of Sinful Man Aspiring Unto the Place of God. In 1957, the magazine Astounding Science Fiction published Thinking Machine. Notice the ambiguities, fiction or fact, machine or man. Again, in 1961, the New Yorker took notice with a computer depicted on the cover of its Valentine's Day issue, 11th February. In 1962, the Times Literary Supplement issued a booklet, Freeing the Mind, compiled from a series of articles on application of computers to language, literature, and library research, including Margaret Masterman's article, which I've already mentioned several times. In 1963, the retrospective collection published by Simon & Schuster, The Modeling of Mind, Computers in Intelligence, brought together papers in neurophysiology, musicology, chess, mathematics, psychology, phenomenology, the philosophy of mind, and computing. Also that year, the Digicomp 1, claimed as the first real operating digital computer in plastic, costing $4.98, a miracle of the space age, offered its purchaser the ability to demonstrate the apparatus hidden within the circuits of the giant brains of today. That's it. A selection representing about 17% of my collection from the years 1946 to 1964, itself only a desultory sampling from the popular and semi-professional literature. It is true that the catalog I have recited represents only a few articles per year from across British, Canadian, and American scenes, and that the whole collection from which the catalog was derived represents only about 28 items per year. But experience suggests that my collection is merely the tip of a proverbial iceberg, and that with sufficient time, a bulk worthy of a true iceberg, and not what Newfoundlanders call a bergy bit, could be discovered. Furthermore, the intensity of interest in the scientific articles, the degree of hype in the popular ones, the rapidity with which computing developed during this time, the massive funding made available for that development, and of course the amount of material always competing for the attention of editors and publishers, all suggest a disproportionate potency behind the numbers. Thank you very much. Again, my intention in subjecting you to this cascade of raw evidence is to bring home the point that the excitement of computing during this time was in North America, and Britain at least, unavoidable to all but the most closely cloistered. But note, the particular variety of excitement I have selected belongs to what we now call the cognitive sciences, and which would then have been distributed across philosophy and psychology. That is, it concerns that most prized of human attributes, thinking. According to Time magazine, when Thomas J. Watson Sr. invented his famous one-word slogan, think, he meant it for his employees. After his son took over, it came to mean what computing was aiming to do one day. His aim was only, as he said, to make automatic a lot of things now done by slow and laborious human drudgery. Others, we will see, had much higher aims than that. So, to those living the life of the mind in the humanities, how could computing not provoke the most intense curiosity? Actually, clearly, it did, within a self-selected crowd. When in 1964 the Literary Data Processing Conference was organized and held in Yorktown Heights by IBM, it attracted 150 literary scholars and computer scientists from North America and Europe. In the foreword to the preceding volume, Jess Bessinger, professor of English at NYU, noted that applications of computer research to the other branches of the humanities were excluded because data processing in the humanities is already too sweeping an activity for brief discussion. He recalled spirited argument between speakers, splinter groups met in the evening to refine, to explore, and to plot, papers from men and women at home in both academy and laboratory, bracing dissonances among them, but consensus that computing was for humanists and computer scientists both, whom humanists regarded as their respected colleagues in a joint endeavor. 2 years later, when Joseph Rabin founded Computers in the Humanities, the first issue attested to Bessinger's too sweeping an activity for brief discussion, and to enthusiasm from distinguished scholars, funding from IBM, meetings, books, and a fellowship program of the American Council of Learned Societies, then already in its third year. But this excitement is immediately qualified, at the time and by a closer look, as we have already seen. For example, the co-editor of the 1964 Proceedings volume, Stephen Parrish, invoked C.P. Snow's indictment of humanistic culture, which Snow had handed down 5 years earlier, and argued deterministically for a relentless, inevitable scientific revolution in which an objective scholarship will render obsolete the studies that rely on the judgment and memory of one poor, fallible human scholar. For who, he asked, would venture to match his analytical powers, his powers of measurement, and his memory against those of an electronic computer? E.G. Fogel, in the first paper that followed, introduced his idea of the vision actuality interval that I mentioned earlier, which he used to caution his audience against too eager an anticipation for fulfillment of the dream, that we are entering into the most exciting and potentially rewarding period of textual criticism that scholars of all periods have ever known. In the same volume, Joseph Millich cautioned differently against the seductive lure of computers used as servile, accurate, high-speed clerks, entirely under the dominion of their scholarly masters, and so apt to divert us from the imaginative work of criticism. 2 years later, in 1966, Millich repeated much the same warning in Computers and the Humanities, as we have seen, in the same year that the whistle was finally blown on the machine translation project, and a few months after Hubert Dreyfus's Alchemy and Artificial Intelligence did the same for Alan Newell's and Herbert Simon's ambitious predictions of 1958. The problem for my history is not simply the realization that what at first seemed imminent arrival had turned into an initial stage in a much longer and more difficult journey. That is perfectly ordinary and to be expected. Rather, it is the nature of the excitement expressed by so many early adopters in the humanities. It is qualified, that is, by the positivistic research program of New Criticism, which I have, as I've said before, matched what computing could then do and what researchers mostly did, by the consequent susceptibility of practitioners like Parrish to the lure of powerful technoscience, and by the closely related temptation to become dominated by the mastery of a machine that did not challenge old critical ideas but merely implemented them. In 1976, Roberto Busa concluded that the problem was precisely the way machines were being used. In a guest editorial, "Why Can a Computer Do So Little?", he fingered the dominant inclination to use a computer just to do things easier and faster. The aim of computing, he declared, was more human work, more mental effort. He did not argue for liberation from drudgery for some other kind of work that is uniquely human and reassuring us in its uniqueness. Rather, he argued, the aim must be to know more systematically, deeper and better with the machine. Like the whistleblowers of the machine translation project in 1966, Busa was pointing away from automation to the need for fundamental research, to understand, as he said beautifully, what is in our mouth at every moment, the mysterious world of our words. On the other hand, work in machine translation from Warren Weaver's famous memorandum of 15th July 1949, raising the possibility of contributing at least something to the solution of the worldwide translation problem, to the ALPAC report of 1966, raises the question of why literary critics were then not in the room. Indeed, among those most closely involved, resistance to the view that fully automatic and good quality translation was a reasonable goal to aim at came most prominently from the philosopher and linguist Yehoshua Bar Hillel, who by 1962 was looking towards a man-machine partnership. He had concluded that the quality of fully autonomous mechanical translation will never approach that of qualified human translators. Like Busa, he called for a radical change in the whole approach. There are a number of obvious reasons why the fence would have been forbidding to look over. For humanists, the rebarbative nature of computing during the incunabular period. For both humanists and scientists, the slow diffusion of ideas across the disciplines. The isolation of research groups, even from each other, within the same discipline. The rapidity with which ideas arose and changed in the absence of explanatory literature, making developments accessible to the outsider. You might conclude that interchange of ideas and views had little to no chance. But again, for the humanists, that is to ignore the reception history of computing in the popular and more scientifically informed media. a small fraction of which I cataloged earlier. For the scientists, of course, poetry was not in the news. But these scientists were, as most now are, well-educated and cultured people. Many of the major figures in the development of computing during the Incunabular period, such as John von Neumann, Norbert Wiener, Warren McCulloch, and many more, themselves of wide interdisciplinary interests, strove to involve as wide a circle of others as possible in their meandering discussions. The clearest manifestations of their aim is to be found in the Macy conferences held by the Joshua Macy Jr. Foundation in New York City from March 1946 to April 1953, and in the Ratio Club, that's not ratio but ratio, in Britain, which met from 1949 to 1958. Here I will focus only on the Macy conferences. There's good documentation for the Ratio Club, but I only recently ran into it and haven't had a chance to read it. Only one scholar from literary studies was ever invited to the Macy conference, the critic Ivor Richards, who was asked to speak on the topic of communication between men, the meaning of language, at the 1951 conference. In the following, I zero in on his paper to consider why, quite apart from the anxieties for which I have argued, Richards was not afraid of machines. In the following, I zero in on his paper to consider why, quite apart from the anxieties for which I have argued, for Richards was not afraid of machines, communication between humanists and scientists was so poor. The results are actually a source for encouragement and direction. Earlier, I drew your attention to the MIT historian David Mindell's argument in Between Human and Machine that although cybernetics was named, and so in that sense created by Wiener in the late 1940s, it was the product of a long series of developments in engineering and related fields from the early 20th century. These developments came together during World War II, when engineers, mathematicians, physiologists, psychologists, and other social scientists were assembled to integrate humans and machines into complex fire control systems for anti-aircraft artillery. To hit a rapidly moving airplane, and by now we had the rapidly moving airplanes, that was in turn tightly integrated with a human operator, the fire control system needed to take account of human psychology and physiology, the mechanics of what the engineers then called, as I said, the machine in the middle. Hence we will see the strong presence of people in those fields at the Macy conferences. After the war, the researchers' heightened sense of accomplishment inspired them to recreate the forcing conditions of military research on a different intellectual plane. Cybernetics was the result. The word cybernetics is from the Greek kubernetes, steersman or governor, which was used as a foundational metaphor to evoke through the interaction of a steersman with the tiller of his boat, the problem Wiener named in the subtitle of his first book on the subject, Control and Communication in Animal and Machine. This is as reliable a short definition as can be found. Wiener and the others discovered that the mathematically describable idea of feedback, central to control and communications systems, and illustrated here, had enormous explanatory power with implications across the disciplines and beyond. Participants at the Macy conferences, for example, shared the sense, and here you really do need to use your historical imagination, the sense that, as Yehoshua Bar Hillel said, cybernetics offered a synthesis that was destined to open new vistas on everything human and to help solve problems of many of the disturbingly open problems concerning man and humanity. Thus, a product of wartime research seemed the best response to problems created or exacerbated by warfare. But something like a new earth, if not a new heaven, seemed almost imminent to these people. The Macy conferences consisted of a core group of 22 people. By the crude measure of their primary disciplines, which in their case is an extremely crude measure, This group included 9 in psychology and psychiatry, 4 in mathematics, 3 in the brain sciences, 2 in engineering, and 1 each in ecology, medicine, sociology, and philosophy. If we enlarge the group to everyone who is involved, including guest speakers, we get 21 in psychology and psychiatry, 12 in the brain sciences, 8 in medicine, physiology, and anatomy, 6 in mathematics and logic, 4 each in anthropology, engineering, and linguistics, 3 in the other social sciences, and 1 each in biophysics, ecology, literary criticism, management, philosophy, and physics. And we think we're interdisciplinary. Richards, as I said, was the lone literary critic. During the time of the conferences, and for some time afterward, the story of cybernetics was being well and widely told. Here's another catalog. For example, by Wiener in his 1948 book I have cited, and in The Human Use of Human Beings, Cybernetics and Society, published in 1950, both hugely popular. By cyberneticians such as the English psychiatrist W. Ross Ashby in An Introduction to Cybernetics, published in 1956. The English psychologist, mechanic philosopher, and creator of Maverick Machines, Gordon Pask, in An Approach to Cybernetics, published in 1961, and in an Encyclopedia Britannica entry in 1972. The American biophysicist Walter Rosenblith in On Cybernetics and the Human Brain, published in 1966. Warren McCulloch in Recollections of Many Sources of Cybernetics, 1974. By contemporary observers such as the British polymath and phenomenologist Michael Polanyi in The Hypothesis of Cybernetics, 1951. And the British management theorist Stafford Beer in What Has Cybernetics to Do with Operational Research, 1959. Cybernetics also hit the art world. In Britain, chiefly through the efforts of the critic, editor, and curator Yasia Reichart, who is still living in London and still alive, but hard to get to see, who staged Cybernetic Serendipity, a major art exhibition in London in 1968, involving people across the disciplines, including the maverick machine man, Pask. She published Cybernetics Art and Ideas in 1971. Cybernetics has been well studied since then, for example, by Mahoney in 1989, Himes 1991, Gallison 1994, Dupuis 2000, and Pickering 2002. Catherine Hale's account in How We Became Posthuman is really quite excellent. Cybernetics gave the electronic stored program machines that had emerged from the war their most intellectually resourceful reception, in part at least because ideas bound up with computing were already there. Alan Turing's 1936 paper on computable numbers had attracted the attention of Warren McCulloch, who together with the mathematical prodigy Walter Pitts applied Turing's model of the universal machine to neurophysiology, resulting in a powerful model of brain functioning described in their foundational paper. And get this title, it is a beautiful title. A Logical Calculus of the Ideas Immanent in Nervous Activity, published in the same year, 1943, as the foundational document of cybernetics, Behavior, Purpose, and Teleology, by Arturo Rosenbluth, Norbert Wiener, and Julian Bigelow. John von Neumann, who worked with Bigelow at the Institute of Advanced Study to build his machine, then incorporated McCulloch's and Pitt's ideas into the first draft report on the EDVAC, which provided the von Neumann architecture for computing machinery that we more or less use to this day. Occurrences of neurophysiological terms in von Neumann's first draft show the influence. McCulloch says in his 1961 Alfred Korsbitzky Memorial Lecture that had it not been for von Neumann's attention to his and Pitt's 1943 paper, it might have remained unknown to biologists and to a lot of other people. The recursive development of mind-machine-machine-mind reflects on a larger scale the principle of recursion at the center of cybernetic thinking. This is where Ivor Richards began his paper on 15th March 1951 for the Macy Conference, again entitled Communication Between Men, the Meaning of Language. Interpersonal Reminiscence, I.A. Richards at Harvard, published in 1981, the literary scholar Helen Vendler remarks that He was the most extraordinary teacher of poetry I ever encountered, a magical presence, a critic with compelled and compelling belief in the absolute reality of the world of poetry. He was, his biographer John Paul Russo writes, an interdisciplinary figure. Aggressively, he read his way through linguistics, philosophical and experimental psychology, aesthetics and neurophysiology, penetrating into the unfamiliar terrain where these disciplines border on one another. In 1919, he was persuaded by Mansfield Forbes of Clare College, Cambridge, to whom he had gone to see for advice on a career in rock climbing, to become a freelance lecturer in the newly established English Tripos. He went on to become one of the great figures of 20th century literary scholarship. New criticism had its origins in his work. The first published essay, Art and Science, his first published essay, Art and Science, in 1919, later developed into the book Poetries and Sciences, whose revisions spanned the middle half of the 20th century. This book significantly marks a great struggle and disagreement, attempting on the one hand to expand the perimeter of criticism by bringing it into contact with the disciplines that were in the forefront of progress. On the other hand, to figure out what the literary imagination could possibly do in a world that had, as he wrote, deprived poetry of its original wellspring, the magical view of the world. By 1951, Rousseau reports, Richards, by his own assessment, had hit the nadir of his career. His book Speculative Instruments, where a revised version of the Macy paper appeared, went largely unread, despite the momentum of cybernetics and rapidly growing influence of his earlier work. Rousseau comments that anyone interested in his topics found his writings to consist of odd, ingenious medleys of ideas. In a review of the Macy Conference's transactions, the cognitive psychologist George Miller agreed. He could not see how all the things in Richards' paper fit together. Rousseau's assessment is that Richards had lost his audience and could not recapture it. Richards' conference paper does wander a bit and is far too long. But my assessment is somewhat different, though close to Rousseau's. It is that Richards had not so much lost his former audience, which was actually growing with the popularity of his literary criticism, rather that he had failed to assemble and hold a new one because he lacked the language. As I have said, I think this was and this is our fundamental difficulty, hence the importance of his Macy paper for us. At the beginning, his paper masterfully sets out the problem. The properties of any apparatus used, he wrote, including preeminently the language of discussion and whatever else you like to put behind the interpretation of language, enter into the investigation, and not only enter into it, but belong essentially to it, and contribute to it, and form and shape it, and I suspect, confine it. Hence, I think, his great interest in moving toward a more synoptic view, as he named his paper in Speculative Instruments, through a diplomatic, philosophic strategy to keep studies in some touch with one another, so that each could help the other out of his disciplinary, of its disciplinary solipsism and move toward genuine conversational exchange. Using analogies from theoretical physics and anthropology, he argued that because no single model exists to moderate among disciplines, relativism, a methodological self-denying ordinance, as he called it, is the first step, but it is only the first step. In the context of a conference on feedbacks and circular mechanisms, he proposed the complement of feedback, for which he coined the term feed-forward, to describe that mechanism by which participants in a conversation, or perhaps even musicians playing jazz together, move the conversation along. He proposed feed-forward as a way of describing how language works, how it is learned, and how a new language, such as the one cybernetics was attempting, is formed. The discussion which followed, and took twice the length of Richard's paper, lacked direction and focus, hardly surprising given the usual difficulties of talking across disciplines to a paper one has not previously read, in a conference setting. But there are moments of great clarity in which the way forward may be glimpsed, when the hard barriers of disciplinary solipsism are softened and begin to crumble. Richards noted that in this kind of speculation, the breakdown of the tool is the important part. We blame the language, and we should instead focus on the language. The polymath and mathematician Walter Pitts observed that a crucial roadblock may seem a matter of principle, but can be a practical matter of stating something simply enough so that people are able to think further. Richards recommended discussion that explicitly expresses the wish or desire to speak contingently in a particular way rather than makes assertion in the full indicative, as if rather than it is. The physicist Donald McKay summarized the portrait of a closed, self-sufficient way of speaking by noting that within the rules of a game, you can never find the justification for playing it. Pitts rendering this by analogy to Gödel's theorem thus: whenever you have a language that is rich enough to talk about language, you always have an incomplete language. As you may know, Gödel's theorem amounts to an argument for the unconquerable creativity of mathematics, for its perpetual freedom to go beyond closed axiomatic systems. In other words, Richards was talking about feeding forward creatively in a long conversation toward that common language that we seek, and we know we'll never quite reach. The subsequent history of cybernetics went along such lines, though tripping over difficulties of its own, as Catherine Hales has described. But I don't think that for literary criticism the situation improved very much. Jerome McGann has exploited the idea of autopoiesis, or self-making systems, which dominated later cybernetics. Jean-Pierre Dupuy, in The Mechanization of Mind, has followed cybernetics into the cognitive sciences, which Mark Turner has pursued from a literary perspective in somewhat the same style as George Miller from a psychological one. That is one place to look, and look carefully for the wherewithal to continue Richard's diplomatic, philosophic project of keeping the disciplines in touch with one another so that a conversation may, through many creative breakdowns, begin to reach a language which bridges computation and criticism. Here the contribution of history is to see that this was happening quite close to the very beginning of our story, to learn what we can from some of the most interesting and intellectually powerful individuals at that time, and to see how great the promise and difficulty of the task we have still before us actually is. Proposing, as McGann has, wild clumps of ideas from elsewhere is a new beginning, but only that. We need to talk, to feed forward, but this small bit of history shows us, do it improvisationally, speaking as if, and keeping that conditionality always in the forefront of our minds. What is said isn't enough. It has to be offered conditionally in order for the inevitable breakdown to come soon enough, gently enough, to be creative. Thus, a year before Richard spoke, the American neurophysiologist Ralph W. Gerard addressed the 7th MACI conference, which he described as the most provocative group with which I am associated, thus: "It seems to me," he said, "in looking back over the history of the group, that we started our discussion in the as-if spirit. Everyone was delighted to express any idea that came into his mind, whether it seemed silly or certain or merely a stimulating guess that would affect someone else. We explored possibilities for all sorts of ifs. Then, rather sharply, it seemed to me, we began to talk in an is idiom. We were saying much the same things, but now saying them as if they were so. Is this not where we so often go wrong? Having fallen in love with our own ideas, and then imprisoned ourselves with them." I end, however, with poetic cybernetics from the fourth part of The Kingfishers by the American modernist Charles Olson, 1910 to 1970, written in the year Wiener published Cybernetics. "We can be precise. The factors are in the animal and or the machine. The factors are communication and or control. Both involve the message. And what is the message? The message is a discrete or continuous sequence of measurable events distributed in time. Is the birth of air? Is the birth of water? Is a state between the origin and the end, between birth and the beginning of another fetid nest? Is change presents no more than itself, and the too strong grasping of it, when it is pressed together and condensed, loses it, this very thing you are. Thanks very much.
And we have 15 minutes for questions. Fantastic.
I'm aching to spend much more time talking about Warren McCulloch, who is one of the major intellectuals of the 20th century, but now almost completely disappeared from the radar. His collected works, you can buy a book called Embodiments of Mind, which is introduced by Seymour Papert and has a preface by Jerome Letvin, a marvelous preface by Jerome Letvin. You can find bits of him here, there, and everywhere. I've collected them all, and I'll be giving them to Jeffrey, so you can probably get them from him. But his official collected works, when it were published by some minor little place in California, and is only accessible now in a few libraries in the United States. But there will come a time when the power of his mind is again appreciated. I hope to have something to do with that. These are tremendous people and tremendous times. I mean, the atmosphere, as I suggested at the beginning in that cover page, get out of the way, Thomas Watson, junior and senior. Now, there's a faster way to do this, I know, isn't there?
You still get
there. Yeah, there we go. That's sort of what it was like. I mean, you get this enthusiasm from coming straight out of the papers. Unfortunately, the people at the Macy conferences didn't really realize how central what they were doing was until they got fairly well into the conferences. So the documentation of the early conferences is very sparse. But Michael Heim's book and Jean-Pierre Dupuis's books are secondary literature on that. And as I say, McCulloch's papers and von Neumann's and a few others give you a sense of what it was like to be pulled off the table by lightning bolts. Jeffrey.
Would there be a thread around the hypertext literature that would run in parallel to literary computing? I think of Nelson's wild and playful books, and then we still, in fact, even now have hypertext conferences and so on. That, of course, that leads up to the web, so maybe that's the triumphant history.
Yeah, well, it's interesting as you and I have been talking about that. There are all these fantastic, wonderful, powerful hypertext tools prior to the web. The web is brain dead in comparison, and the brain dead won the day. Why that was so, and what it is, why it is that despite the power of these, the obvious power of these tools like Fress and Intermedia and stuff, why they're just gone. I mean, there have been sort of rear guard actions trying to keep that stuff alive, but just simply hasn't worked. That's another one of those stories about why didn't literary scholars catch on? Why didn't they seize on to Fress and run with it? I mean, it was developed at one of the elite institutions in the United States, where there's money, coming out of the fountains.
Well, Landau certainly grabbed onto one aspect of it in the sort of hypertext theory.
But Landau is not a particularly good evangelist to doubters. He's in hyper mode all the time, pretty much. I mean, I like George very much, but if you go to Victorian Web, Yeah, is that it? The Victorian web or something of that sort. It looks oddly old-fashioned and stilted, and you know, it's like people that line up their gods on the mantelpiece and sort of a panoply of stuff, and it's very hard to work with, very stilted. Doesn't give that very sense of liberation that these people clearly felt of what could be done with hypertext, expressed by Vannevar Bush in his paper on the Memex, and wonderfully promoted by the article in Life magazine, which was a simplification of the Atlantic Monthly article with these drawings by Creamy, in fact. Mm-hmm. Creamy drew the picture of the Memex with the parts you could see in it, and the man with a television camera on his forehead, this was going to be part of the future. But the just runaway electric excitement of these researchers is everywhere, certainly in the hypertext literature. I don't know that that answered any question.
I think Ted Nelson has some of that same excitement. And you remember in 1989 he came and talked at the...
Yeah, I tried to tell him about what I was doing with the web. He was not interested. He was not interested in the web. He saw the new heaven and the new earth, and anything of this earth and this heaven, he was just bored by.
But my memory is that the 1989 conference, he told us about, he'd just done the deal with Autodesk, and he was telling us, you know, there will be in your neighborhood, you can go into a store, and there'll be a pimply teenager with a beanie cap who will sit you down and give you your account on the DocuVerse. You know, give me 1 year, and you will all be joining the DocuVerse. And Tim Berners-Lee, in the meantime, is happily making it work. I don't think Ted Nelson has ever forgiven him.
Yeah, what can we learn from, other than the you know, examples of human foolishness and naivete and so on and so forth, what can we learn from, what of our new heaven and new earth can we see in their visions of that? I'm struggling with this, so it's just, you know, me running off the mouth. But it's something like a process of translation to look at, for example, Margaret Masterman's Telescope of the Mind. Well, she was thinking very positivistically of the world out there, which we can't see because we don't yet have the telescope. So we get this telescope of the mind, and all of a sudden the mind can see all these things. We don't think about things out there quite like that anymore. So how do you take that and translate it into something that is intellectually respectable in our day?
Do you not find that we're at a moment of excitement somewhat equivalent to what you're seeing here?
Here, yes, I can, yeah. Of course. Yeah. I mean, here it's quite tangible. I mean, in the activities of HUCO and everything circling around it is definitely that sense of being on to something. I feel that I'm on to something. Know a few other people that are very much possessed by this enthusiasm. It is not particularly good, you know, it's not particularly polite to express it very much. Yeah.
I wasn't here for the rest of the lecture series, and I'm very sorry that I wasn't now, because now I have to ask.
They're
a
being
question.
Podcast.
Are they?
Yep.
Good, because I was one of
the. See, here's the device right here.
Terrific. So my question is, what are you on to?
It's sort of like. It may turn out to be Pandora's box, but I think it's more like the fairy tale pouch that is full of coins and never can be emptied. It's a discovery of an enormous wealth in stuff that we've forgotten. The excitement is in the realization of the fact that we don't have a history, and that the history we may be able to write someday will connect us with this wealth in a meaningful way. I mean, you know, it's fun to handle old stuff and to look at 1964 Globe and Mail and the things that they were saying and to exclaim, oh, they knew that even then, you know. But that doesn't connect us to it in a meaningful way.
No, because we are surprised. Oh, gosh, we knew that even then.
The even then thing betrays the expression. Is it, you know, we're so smart now, and people back in 1964, you know, they were sort of shuffling along.
Somehow. So it's about value of knowledge that we already have, that we've forgotten.
We've forgotten, yes. And that recovery of what we have forgotten, and the recovery in its historical context, which makes it strange, the recovery of the moment in which you can stand and see all these possibilities as yet unexplored, as yet unknown. To put yourself, this is Greg Denning talking more or less, to put yourself in the position at which you don't know what the future is. And there are all these possibilities spreading out before
you. But you need to do your research.
You need to do an awful lot of research, yes. You need an awful lot. And, you know, I've spent a couple of years on this now, and I'm just beginning.
Do you have enough time?
No, I don't have enough time. Even if I, you know, live as long as I'd like to, I don't have enough time. But
who are you passing the torch to?
Well, I'll do what I can in the next 3 years to bring this to completion as a book. But
has somebody come forward to you at all and said, I'm passionate about this?
Jeffrey's working on an archive here. The archive is I think what is needed to get this history better done than I will be able to do it is to collect historical materials together, make them accessible, and then open it up to, let's say, students of history of technology, students who are interested in the history of science and technology, and related fields, and start to, you know, just point somebody looking for a dissertation project, say, behold, here are many dissertation projects that will excite the world. And to get to collect the material into an archive, to organize the archive, get the metadata and all that and access mechanisms and so on and so forth, and then get people to work on it.
How you doing? Do you need any help? Has anybody said that to you before? Do you need any help?
Talk to Jeffrey.
Yeah, I think in this room we've got Jeffrey and Harvey and Sean are all part of that project.
Victoria.
So yeah, there's a group.
It's a tremendously important project because, as I, in one of the previous lectures, I used Nori Fry's bit about the formation of a real discipline. He's talking about the sciences, but it applies to all disciplines. If we can get from simply having a bunch of facts to having questions that those facts stir, then you start to have a history. You take that Baconian great inductive leap to a perspective from which you begin to see patterns. You begin to have questions about why choices were made.
I'm good at questions.
Well, we need to be much better at it. But this is the sort of endeavor.
Thank you for being here.
I have a question for you. Maybe a comment and then a question. One is, I take it from your talk today that kind of what we really need is a new Macy conference. It's kind of a big interdisciplinary thing where we can get a lot of people and maybe more than just one literary scholar. And then I started thinking about, well, why would they have something as big as the Macy conferences and only one literary scholar is really interested in showing up? Which leads me to my question, which is, I think that it has something to do with the way that we think about computers, our metaphors for computers. You know, a computer is, you know, fill in the blank. And I think that's changed so much over time. And so my question really is, have you noticed that, and in which ways? Because even if you just take like 1946 or 45 or Turing's work, a computer is a substitute for a room full of people with slide rules. and then over time, the computer becomes a more general purpose input-output device. And again, I'm thinking of that great, the one that I'm probably going to have to find, you have to get a point me to it, the Time magazine cover where the computer's in the background and everybody's huddled around the output. And then, like when Jeffrey says, you know, you get hypertext with Ted Nelson and Tim Berners-Lee, the computer becomes a portal into an entire network of data that I have access to, which is a very different metaphor for computing, a different model for computing. So today, now, the computer is, you know, where our lives are. Computers are our telephones, and they're our movie theaters, and we use them for television. You know, my whole correspondence of email is there. So it's a very intimate and personal reflection of my life and who I am, which is not in any way, shape, or form how McCulloch or Pitts or Turing would have thought of a computer. It's a radically different kind of a thing today than it was then. So I guess my question really is, what's your impression of the metaphors of computing that are really operative at this time? And how does that influence the ways in which we bring humanists back? And as I ask it, I recognize now that that question doesn't really make much sense. I'll give it to you anyway. And then
no, it makes sense. It's just I can't answer it. I don't know what the metaphors are at the moment.
Yeah.
I think it is misleading to... Oh, it's convenient. It's linguistically convenient to say the computer.
Yeah.
But we know that there is no such thing as the computer. There are as many computings as there are the human imagination to invent. The Turing scheme is a scheme for an abstract scheme for an indefinite number of machines. So computing is really a plural noun. I use computing rather than computation because computation, I take it, really belongs to the science of what is computable, and that's for mathematical computer science. But computing in terms of its presence in the world, their presence in the world is an indefinitely many. How we are thinking about computing today, I don't know. I mean, the professionals talk in one way. How the chat is going elsewhere, or even if it is happening, even if it appears this conversation, this excitement, appears to have vanished. Try to get the Times Literary Supplement interested in computing now. They are really not interested. They were intensely interested in the 60s. They're not interested at all now. It's I think the appliance has taken over. But that is, I don't trust that impression. Because I haven't done the corpus analysis.
Yeah.
You know, go to the web through WebCorp, which turns the web into a corpus for examination by concordance tools, and look for, what would you look for? That's the problem. If computer and computing doesn't, I don't know, I mean, computers are everywhere now of the fixed variety. So I'm floundering around because I don't really know. You're asking about now.
Yeah, and I think just part of a bigger project, which is, maybe Paul can even speak to this, about how to bring, because I think one of the reasons our colleagues in the humanities oftentimes look askance at us or aren't interested in computers is because I think now they actually have an incorrect metaphor for computing and computers. And so they just can't, it doesn't become what you're calling it and what Danny Hillis calls it too, right? An imagination machine. It doesn't become an imagination machine, but they have an idea about what computers are and a metaphor for that. And that's a very restrictive...
It's what I'd call the knowledge jukebox.
Yeah, yeah.
You push a button and you get out, you know, all the articles published about X.
Right, exactly.
Which is great, but it's not the imagination machine.
Right, yeah.
Like that. I like the jukebox. I actually actually want to go from the now to the then, and I want to do it via Harvey's question, or first comment, which raised another question for me, because I think you said only one literary scholar cared to participate. That was the term you used. It made me realize that I've been assuming this was by invitation, that we were talking about the Macy conference. So it's not clear to me that these were open.
No, they weren't open.
So we're not talking about people caring. We're talking about the formation of a discourse, and who is seen to be relevant to that.
I wish I had the committee minutes, if there were committees and were minutes, where somebody said, "We need a literary critic. Who could we get?"
See, and that connects to my second question, which is that they did ask. In fact, I think she's been described as being part of the core group, Margaret Mead.
Yeah, Gregory Bateson and Margaret Mead.
And because it's that we're really talking. I could ask lots of questions too, but one comment, which is the 46 to 53, is just dead on the heart of the early Cold War.
Yep.
And so that's going on. But the other thing that's happening in the first half of the 20th century is the formation of new professions, right? And one of the things that interests me as a literature scholar is the way in which the emergence of anthropology and the increasing and the success of anthropology in setting the terms of the debate over what's culture. Right? And Margaret Mead's at the center of that. And to swing it back to the Cold War, she's a consultant for the American government when they're invading countries like Japan. Right?
Yep.
Because she's going to give them the local knowledge.
So was Bateson in Southeast Asia, I think.
My sense is if literature isn't being seen as relevant, what is seen as relevant are the new disciplines that are increasingly the go-to places for to understand what literature used to. People used to think of literature understood. Does that make sense as a comment? And I guess a question, if you can say anything more about Margaret Mead or Bateson and the role of anthropology in all of this.
I've read a little bit of what Bateson said at the Macy conferences and in an interview later that was published in the Coevolution Quarterly, which some people with gray to white hair in the room will remember. But I haven't taken that stuff in enough. I haven't looked at it enough to be able to comment on how she related to what was going on. I mean, they clearly saw in cybernetics the possibility for addressing serious problems created by warfare. And they were both seriously burnt out by their involvement with the government in figuring out how to invade people and what they would do once they were invaded. It was a very cynical use of anthropology, but I shouldn't say cynical, because this was the Second World War, and it was a war of pretty serious affair, actually. There was a lot at stake. And so people were deployed as Mead and Bateson were deployed just to try to figure out how to win something that had to be won.
Yes. And anthropology played that role then and is still playing it. I mean, anthropologists are very much involved in Iraq and Afghanistan and the discipline itself actively debates, their involvement in this, right? So that goes back to the thing about the development of the discipline, it's inseparably linked with that. And I think you were arguing, a few lectures ago, that computing is in some ways inseparably linked from these larger things as well.
Oh, yes, it is inseparably linked from the development of machinery for war. And that makes what we can learn from it a very complex affair.
And makes the knowledge jukebox such an interesting counterpart to that. Yeah. However inadequate in itself.
Sean, did you have
short question. I couldn't help thinking that the period you're describing, the 50s and the first half of the 60s, coincided with a very important period in science fiction, and that maybe there might be a connection. I mean, I'm sure there's a connection between this enthusiasm in the capabilities of computing in the research of that time, and the metaphor of artificial intelligence in the science fiction writings of the period. And I was wondering if you are going to touch on this subject in your book.
I don't know. I mean, Kate Hales does an awfully good job of that in How We Became Posthuman, of concentrating on the literature of the period. I'm not sure that all of it is classed as science fiction, but it's very much in that direction. It's a matter of whether I feel I have time to stretch in that direction or simply lean on what she has already done. But yes, of course, it's very important because here are people imaginatively responding and feeding developments. At the 2009 ASILOMAR conference, held by the American Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, they called in science fiction writers to get scenarios of what AI might produce, and then dismissed these as unrealistic fantasies. But it, you know, they actually invited science fiction writers.
That's why you asked them with imagination, so they can picture something that doesn't exist. As a scientist,
well, they want to say it's okay. You know, we've got control of it.
Self-assurance. Good, I'm not crazy. Thank God.
So I was intrigued that you drew a conclusion from a lot of those early samples that the focus was on computing in the brain. So I was wondering why that might be the case. And I think it's Peter Berger who has this sort of theory about different phases of the introduction of technology, that you have a first phase in which everyone tries to describe the new technology in terms of something else.
Yeah.
Then you have, and then I can't remember quite how the progression goes, but eventually the technology becomes transparent, so we're no longer describing it in terms of anything. In fact, we begin to describe other things in terms of it.
Mm.
And it seems that what you're witnessing there is the brain is one of the things that especially popular writers or people writing for a larger public, when they're seeking around for something to explain the computer by, they fall on this idea of the brain. And we know that IBM, I believe, resisted calling computers computers for a long time because they wanted to avoid any discussion of these machines are going to replace people.
Yes, like yes. Someone, who is it, claims to have seen IBM literature in which the customer engineers and salesmen of IBM were instructed to use moron was the word, to call the computer a fast moron. Instruction went out from central headquarters that they were to promulgate the view that computers were fast morons because people were getting scared and wouldn't buy the machines if they thought they could think.
So I'm wondering if what you're finding is this sort of first phase where, to paraphrase Harvey, people are looking for metaphors, looking for something to explain the computer. And if now perhaps we're in the phase where, I mean, nowadays we seem to be explaining the mind as a computer.
The history goes back well into the 19th century, if not before. There's a book by the historian of science and English professor Laura Otis called Networking, which is an extremely good book, by the way, in which she shows the alternation of attempts to explain the body in terms of exterior machines and attempts to explain exterior machines in terms of the body. And this comes from the discovery of electricity and the attempt to understand the body and the body as a telegraph and the telegraph as a kind of nerve transmission system. And it goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So when McCulloch comes onto the scene, and happens to get interested in neurophysiology, he joins a conversation which had been going on. And this conversation includes, as David Mendel shows, the attempts to cope with the size of the United States and the problems, particularly the United States, but also very much Canada, the problems posed by the size of the country from sea to sea, and how to design transmission systems so that the land actually could be settled and organized and stuff. And this posed enormous problems in how electrical signals were transmitted. So you have many different strands of development going on simultaneously, non-causally related, but intermingling, and sometimes the imagery going from one to the other and then from the other to the one. In Felix Kahn, the German what is the name of the book? I can't remember. It has a number of, you've probably seen it, a number of very splendid plates of the body industrially imagined. In showing, for example, a cross-section of the brain and had the production of speech and the reception, and you have little men doing various things inside the head. And the Industriepalast, the body as an Industriepalast, is one of his drawings. It shows various industries explaining human physiology. And that's one snapshot phase of this alternation back and forth.
So what were the metaphors that were being played with in literary computing? I'm sort of guessing the Nelson's DocuVerse metaphors about the library, that what computing is going to give us is a global library or something like that.
Mm.
The electric book. Maybe what your point is that we haven't had those sort of compelling metaphors to get people excited, or nobody's been able to convey the excitement around these metaphors.
The either or way in which these things are often discussed sort of squashes that kind of resonance. We're going to replace the book.
Mm-hmm.
Why the hell should we want to do that? The book is a brilliant technology, works brilliantly. There are other things that we can do. You know, why do we want to think in terms of, if we bring in the computer, we must toss out the book?
So the giant brain, you have on the one hand people using the brain to describe it, and then you have the science fiction paranoia about, well, then we get 2001.
When I first picked up the report on the EDVAC, the first draft of the report on the EDVAC by von Neumann, and he's talking about neurons in his design of the computer. I thought, what the hell is going on here? He's talking about neurons. And then I later on found the documentation, particularly McCulloch's recognition that von Neumann had picked up that 1943 paper and then just drunk all those ideas in. Until Minsky showed that the McCulloch and Pitts argument of neural functioning didn't work. And it was Minsky who studied with McCulloch. He showed that it didn't work. But even so, that model is still pretty much the way we think of neural architecture, is of what we call outside the brain a neural net, and these binary firings and such.
To say, but we've gone a little bit over our emergent habit of going 15 minutes over.
If I stay here long enough, I'll never leave.
Yeah. Thank you.